Hello, everyone, and welcome from here in the capital city of Austin, Texas. This is Capital Geek, a podcast dedicated to the founders and operators that create the products we love and turn them into fabulous companies with meaningful exits. Whether you're raising your first round of capital or racing toward an IPO, this is where we deep dive on the lessons learned from seasoned industry veterans, geeks of all types, the experts leading product and engineering teams, operations and finance, or sales and marketing, and we'll both learn from their mistakes and celebrate their successes while providing a roadmap for you to accelerate your own journey toward success. My name is Josh Stevens, CTO at Elsewhere Partners, and I am the Capital Geek. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's show. On this episode of Capital Geek, we speak with Chris Holmes, CEO and founder at Gray Matter. Gray Matter builds a hybrid mesh solution to secure and operationalize today's very complex networks. Today should be a very exciting show. Let's get started. Chris, good morning and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Josh. Looking forward to this.
It's a weird time, huh? We're all working from home and dealing with the coronavirus scare. And I read this morning it's only 99 days until the next presidential election.
Yeah. You know, I haven't even had enough time to soak any of that stuff in with all the craziness going on with COVID and trying to handle, you know, 60 plus people and think about, you know, what the right moves are. It's crazy.
It's a difficult time to run a business. You know, I think that it's one of those times where things are very unpredictable, and you know, that's what makes running a business really hard. I think when you can't invest in trajectories and patterns that you're used to, that, you know, you can rely on. You know, I think we have to start with this episode with a little bit of background, because what Gray Matter does, what your company does, while it's something that you and I understand because we have a deep background in this technology, I think for most people it's a little bit mind-boggling. And so maybe we could just sort of start, before we deep dive on the technology and what the company does, with sort of why. Like, why did you decide to head down this path of this type of solution?
So I'm glad you asked, actually. You know, in my past, my brother and I, my CTO, we worked at a company named Decipher. And they're pretty well known, actually. They were a little company in Norfolk, Virginia, that created trading card games. And they also managed fan club stores. So they managed the Star Wars fan club. They managed the Lord of the Rings fan club. They managed Star Trek online. And we were thrusted into an environment where we had to take the traditional trading cards with the fan clubs. At the time when I did this, you know, magazines were still being published and printed and sent out to fans. And they were augmenting it with online capabilities, online forums, online stores, all before Amazon ruled the universe. They had their own little warehouse because they also managed their own pick, pack, ship procedures. We had a warehouse that was full of like Star Trek figures and Lord of the Rings cards and how to host murder games, which is how Decipher originally started back then. And our job was make all that stuff connected, make it all work seamlessly. You know, the trading card games, I was actually doing an all hands yesterday and somebody laughed when I said, we built this, and they were like, really? They had a tournament system and they would give out prizes, and this was national. People go to these little game stores and you'd see the kids playing the trading card games. Well, they would be ranked in a national system that they got scored, and then prizes would be sent out. Those prizes might be discounts to buy other stuff in online stores. They were using File System Pro to manage their back-end systems. And we actually ripped all that out and put an entire ERP system where we connected their warehouse and their pick, pack, ship procedures with all of the picker or all the shippers, to their financials, to an online front store system that was automatically created to a tournament system. So as time has passed. I mean, hell, this was early 90s, I guess, late 90s, like .NET was still in beta.
Yeah, late 90s, we're mostly still in Visual Basic.
Yeah, I mean, it was late 90s, early 2000s, and, you know, it was all cool tech, and as the tech has matured, we became sort of known for building out an ERP model like this for a lot of different business cases. And, you know, most recently we had did it with the federal government, and cloud hasn't changed the fact that you still need to do enterprise resource planning. It actually makes it more complicated because you've got existing investments similar to this. You've got more choice. You've got multi-cloud. You've got, you know, investments that are wrapped up in, some people will call it legacy. I like to refer to it as brownfield. Many of those are critical systems. And then you've got to make a choice on how you're going to continue to offer more solutions to your customers. And that's a lot. And we built Grey Matter sort of to connect all of that together. Because that's what we knew how to do. We know how to connect all these disparate things together to create an enterprise resource plan, most effective for the business, customer, bottom line, and top line, really.
Yeah, you know, when I think about what Grey Matter does, to me, it sort of fulfills the promise of what a virtual private cloud could have been had that term and that technology not been invented within the silo of a single public cloud provider.
Yes.
Right? Because if I understand correctly, the focus for the company and the technology is to create this, you know, we call it a hybrid mesh, but this virtual private cloud, this logical connection of disparate resources from within multiple different public clouds, multiple private clouds, data centers, you know, even within disparate VLANs within one data center, right? To make it all appear as if it's all together local. And then to do that in a zero trust way so that it's entirely secure. And I think that's another example of a term that I think that even fairly technical leaders like myself may struggle with is the zero trust model.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you could take a moment and just sort of give us a quick, you know, cursory overview of the way you think about zero trust.
I will. So before I do that, I did want to go back because you said something that actually sparked something that I've been pretty passionate about researching and talking about and writing about recently, is the conundrum of large vendors taking terms like virtual private cloud and then sort of churning them into, unfortunately, a marketing spin. We're seeing the same thing with hybrid, actually. Lots of people are saying our solution's hybrid. But hybrid actually doesn't mean I buy a rack of your stuff and put it next to the other 25 racks that I already have in my enterprise. That's just an extension of their stack. It's not agnostic. I still have all the work that I have to do to take the 25 racks that are running my brownfield and connecting them to the hybrid environment that you just gave me. You need a virtual network that can cross all those boundaries, which is what Grey Matter allows to do. On the zero trust side, it's a buzzword, point blank. The way we actually view zero trust, quite simply, is explicit security rules, explicit security across every edge on your network, whether it's inside or outside your network.
Yeah, you know, I can remember.
And it can be cumbersome when you do it, but it is really, really explicit.
Well, it's better than it used to be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I can remember back in the 90s and even in the early 2000s, you know, building zero trust networks by hand, right? So you're going to your firewalls and routers, you're denying all, you're very explicitly letting in, you know, node-to-node, you know, routes and connections. And, you know, at the time, And I remember this well because a buddy of mine sort of taught me a lesson in hazing through this technology. You know, at the time, if you had an access list or a firewall rule in today's nomenclature, it could be hundreds of lines long or even thousands. But there for a while, if you typoed one line, you had to kill the whole list and start over.
Yep.
And one of my first jobs out of the military is we were designing and deploying Sprint's first cell phone network. And a part of that process was typing in these 30-page router configurations to these routers. And, you know, I did that job for about 3 weeks before the other guys finally patted me on the back and said, "Hey, Josh, you know you can copy and paste this stuff, right?" And so for 3 weeks, I mean, my fingers were just smoking. I was typing as fast as I could type all day long, every day. Had no idea I could just copy and paste that straight from the engineering doc, which I'd written to start with. And so, you know, that was one of those great hazing moments for me back in INS, where my buddies were just giving me a hard time. But it's come a long way, you know. I mean, in the old days, you had to really think this stuff through and kind of be lucky as well as good to make it work. But through technology like Gray Matter, you know, it's more UI driven. It's presented in a logical way. And, you know, when you have technology like your products that are tailor built specifically for this purpose, I think it becomes a lot easier to accomplish what you set out to do.
Well, the other thing about it, Josh, honestly, is when you look at stuff in the space as it exists today, not just Gray Matter, but Gray Matter does do things to make it easier. It's decentralized. And it's less, if I make a change to this or if I make a change to that, I could impact, you know, hundreds of nodes. Because the security and the explicit security rules have really been pushed down to those edge kind of services. And I'm not just talking about IoT devices. I'm talking about at the granular level of the API itself, or even if you go into the API, at the function, at the server call, whether it's a serverless call or not, you're almost setting rules explicitly at that level. So you can actually do things and experiment and lock things down at a level where you're not going to potentially take offline, you know, hundreds of cell towers or hundreds of routers or hundreds of perimeter or firewall rules. And the other thing that we're finding is as you start to put these things into production enterprises, the new tech is better. No doubt about it. The old way is really prevalent everywhere. Again, it is easy for you to walk in, and I do a lot of work with the military and the federal defense customer sets. You know, largest enterprise on the planet. It's easy for somebody to say, "Well, we'll just use containers, and this is all going to magically go away." But no enterprise is like that, not the largest one on the planet or any of these larger companies that have these. Those rules, those things that you just talked about doing, the router rules, the firewall rules, those still exist. The issue is a lot of the people that put those in place are gone. They've moved on and they haven't really been documented. And it's really hard to uncover those things. And one of the things we're finding with the mesh technology itself is because you're at it at a granular level in a decentralized mode, you can actually start to surface those things. And you can say, well, we should port these rules from, you know, this layer 2 firewall or this layer 1 and 2 device on the network into the mesh itself. And it'll be documented. We've got that nice UI on top of it. We've got AI anomaly detection throughout it, so you can actually alert if it changes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are things that you can absolutely do now, and that's where the simplicity is going to come in.
So it sounds like, you know, hybrid mesh and Gray Matter specifically, this is really a big network problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like the kind of thing that you would decide to invest in when you have a complex, you know, large network. That that would allow you or afford you the opportunity to invest like this and think more strategically about, you know, zero trust and access to data.
It's true. It's not just for the big guys though. I mean, we're a small company and we're actually running everything ourselves through our own gray matter service mesh. That's afforded me a couple of other things, insight into, should I be paying for Freshdesk because of it, you know, are people using it to the extent that they should? Has it been locked down? How do we manage our access to binaries where customers want to come in and download Nexus? We have that all running behind the network, that for lack of a better term, that private cloud networking mesh. And we can see everything. So it's not just for the bigs. It is very helpful for the bigs as they are migrating their pathway. But for the smalls just starting, it is insight. It is a better way to manage your strategic roadmap as you are going to grow. Talk a little bit about what we just did with COVID API Hub. There was a small group of, you know, four individuals that put up an open source API for COVID. It's great. It's the Novel COVID. I think it's their URL is disease.h@.sh. Just a group of kids that wanted to do something good for the public. So they built this API. They had it running on three honking Linux servers in a closet that cost them good chunk of change to run. But again, when they started, they had no idea what was going to happen. Well, that thing blew up. It turned into the number one API that Israel and some of other countries in Europe used as their go-to for, you know, COVID data. Much like the United States went to the Johns Hopkins University platform, those guys used this as their go-to for COVID data. We set up an API hub. We set up a gray matter public service instance that acts as an API gateway and also service mesh. And we wrapped their API and we reached out to them and they said, oh my God, this is great, because they were going to spend a number of dollars on an APM management suite because they had no idea where all this traffic was coming from. They had no idea what their resource usage was other than looking at the actual Linux box logs. They certainly weren't even thinking about security. So we said, we'll host this for you and we'll give you what you're asking for, because by putting it behind the mesh, we can do all of those things for you. And it's been actually a really good relationship.
So in addition to enhanced security and reachability, I think the analytics are a part of the solution that are sort of understated, you know. But when I think about modern technologies versus traditional infrastructure types, most people get hung up on, you know, the whether or not it's secure or more secure, whether or not it's easy to use or harder to use or more expensive. And I think we get hung up in that conversation, but I think the real differentiator is the analytics. And I think in any modern platform where we're data-based and we have the ability to integrate AI and ML layers into our products, without those analytics, you're sort of shooting in the dark.
You know, I started this as a bootstrap company, and we are still bootstrapped. And I have been learning all kinds of lessons as we've been in business. And one of the things that hit me pretty hard, you know, about a year and a half ago was, what is the number one thing that's going to have somebody start having the conversation? And it's always security. What do you do from my cyber perspective? What do you do from my security perspective? At least with the companies that we've talked to. And we have a really strong story there. And we've been building a stronger story on network segmentation, microservice segmentation, app segmentation, all that good stuff. But it is the get in the door question.
Yeah.
The what keeps you in the door is the analytics. It is okay, great. So we buy off on the security. You definitely can help us, especially in a multi-cloud hybrid environment. But what keeps you in the game is the value add analytics that you get from the platform after they've put it in place. The insight that a line manager has gotten that he's never had before, the insight that an architect or an IT manager gets that he's never had before, not without having to go to N number of reports or N number of APM tools. And it's kind of out of the box because we ride the network. We don't have to do any kind of instrumentation to collect any of this information. We just have the information. For a long time, when we first implemented Gray Matter in our first customer's beta, we were dropping a lot of this information on the floor because they weren't using it for the analysis. They weren't looking at it from an operations intelligence perspective. And that's changed.
I think that's it's interesting because whether you're talking about hybrid mesh solutions for security and access, or whether you're talking about business process automation using a BPM tool, we had Brian Reel from Process Maker on a couple of weeks ago. I think that a lot of times, especially technical teams, will be tempted to try to either build from scratch or to maybe couple together several different open source tools into a solution. And you can do that. And I would never want to try to talk people out of that. You learn a ton when you have time to do that. And it's a great process and it's a great model. But once you begin to lean on something like this for real business outcomes, we can talk about capabilities and ease of use and features of the core functionality, you might say. But the real difference between what you guys are doing and what someone can do on their own is that you're able to take what you learn from all of your customers around what makes good analytics and then summarize that and coalesce that into a best practice solution. And that's something you just can't do on your own. And when I think about enterprises, and in some cases, large organizations that have, dozens of people working on this type of technology, that is the place where they always fall short, is in the reporting and analytics. Because I just
Always.
don't think you can get there with the perspective that you have as one user, as one company. I think it requires a broad access, and I think that's the real advantage that you guys have.
Yeah, I mean, there's a, you know, and I like to think that we have a number of advantages, but that is a huge one. My PR guy and I sort of coined this term, the cost of free. There is definitely a cost of free. Lots of people will walk in and be like, oh, well, we're just going to use open source. It's not going to cost us any money. In fact, we think that it costs more money over time because you're going to have to groom your staff. You're going to have your staff become experts in not just one open source capability, but probably a number to get the functionality that the business needs out of anything. You're going to have to piecemeal together a bigger solution that you're grooming expertise in, that it's going to be hard to retain that talent for that enterprise. And all of that is at the expense of the talent that you have in your enterprise doing what matters most to your business, which is keeping your customers, retaining your customers. And that's why solutions like Gray Matter and other vendor products exist, because it's easy to turn that button on and buy it and gain that expertise through the subscription and continue to get the output that you need from that layer of your technology and past and beyond it. You can't possibly, in our space, the amount of telemetry that gets collected on that network at layer 3, 4, 7, the amount of content that flows through east, west, north, south traffic, the sheer amount of rules in an explicit security model. You can't possibly have just a dashboard that shows you, hey, here's the state. You have to go beyond that. You have to get to the active and passive collaboration with a DevOps engineer who's sitting in a Knocker SOC saying, this is an event I care about, this is an event I don't care about. You have to have an AI and you know, enabling brain inside that network that says, this is what we think you ought to be paying attention to. This is where your resources are going to. But at the same time, you know, your business told us this isn't really a number one critical factor for it. So those kinds of reward systems from an AI perspective are going to be increasingly critical in a mesh, in a hybrid environment, in a multi-cloud environment. That's what we're focused on. That's absolutely what we're focused on, because a human being can't possibly look at all of this information and say, I'm going to be, you know, I there's not enough hours in the day for a human to make any decisions at that point.
You know, when I was at SolarWinds, we hired a guy who became a good friend of mine. He's a senior executive now. His name's Denny LeConte. And he used to ask, when it came to some of these things, he would ask if it was free like a puppy or free like a beer.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's a great metaphor, in my opinion, right, for open source software. And even without open source, just what the cost of free can really be. And it can be extreme. And I would argue that oftentimes cheap is as bad as free in terms of what it really costs you, because you're having to augment and combine multiple tools to get the same functionality you would have gotten through one vendor. You know, maybe we back up a moment, and I'll try to cover some of this when I record the intro. But it occurs to me that there are probably people out there that are listening to us that have absolutely no idea what we're talking about, because we sort of started with a base set of knowledge. So maybe we back up and, you know, in your words, tell us sort of why someone would go about deploying the type of solution and what it does. I mean, obviously this is an evolution of what VPNs used to be used for, so we can kind of start there. But maybe you could demystify that for us a little bit.
Sure. So, you know, we're all about creating that mesh network across all of your assets, brownfield, greenfield. The answer in industry has been this concept of a service mesh. And a service mesh has a few pieces to it. It's got a control plane, which is your command and control for all of the things that are running on your network inside the mesh that the mesh is aware about. And then it's got a data plane. And the data plane from a service mesh perspective is usually in a form factor of a proxy that gets pushed out to all of these small, you know, all these code level environments, doing things like a developer won't have to worry about wiring up MTLS in his code anymore. A developer won't have to try to figure out how to secure his application behind something like KeyCloak with OAuth and OID, because the proxy can handle that for them. A developer can potentially have a TCP service that gets transformed into an HTTP service. So some things like the old ESB used to do, but on a much more micro scale, and not with all of the bells and whistles that made USBs become bottlenecks in middleware. It really is the future of that kind of functionality. The developer doesn't have to worry about auditing, because there's no reason for him to write special instrumentation code. A developer can use open source tools like Jaeger or Zipkin for tracing and seeing things. Just trying to take some of those generic kind of things that developers have to deal with when they're writing new services, and regardless of their language, and extracting the networking pieces, extracting the cumbersome pieces that developers shouldn't have to worry about, the plumbing, into that data plane for the command and control to manage. That way the developer can actually focus on the business logic that he wants to build.
In that case, in a large enterprise, you know, there's an overhead with running the service mesh in terms of people that operate it, but it sounds like what you're saying is that it's a net negative overhead, meaning at the end of the day, it saves you time, because while you have the administration load of maintaining the service mesh, you have a much simpler role for all of your developers and DevOps. And so you gain that time back.
I was going to say it's in our customer experiences, it actually translates into a fairly high net positive.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Right. Imagine if a developer for every service that they were writing was also going to package their own firewall, their own web proc, their own Nginx proxy, or Flask, or whatever they're going to do, and their own auditing capability and their own whitelist, blacklist, ACL kind of logic. Imagine every single service that was put on the net today had that embedded inside of it. The enterprise would never know what's on their network. They would never be able to manage it. They would have to go back to that particular developer who developed all that in case any rules ever changed. You don't want the developer to do that. And quite frankly, most developers don't want to actually have to deal with that. A DevOps engineer, as you're moving up the stack, certainly doesn't want that, because now you're handing off an individual stack, if you will, for every single service or application that you're writing in your developer chain, that the DevOps guy is going to be told you have to manage and maintain it. You're going to have to figure out how to deploy it and make it scale and keep it operational. The IT architect and the IT managers are going to hate it, because they're not going to be able to answer any questions that the C-level, the CIOs and the CTOs are going to be asking for, saying, well, where's my cost? Why is this going up? Why is it rising? Why does this keep failing? Why does this keep falling over every time we've got 25 users hitting it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? That kind of all goes away. So there is definitely a net positive, because the service mesh pulls those things out of those code bases. And, for us, we're really focused on the administration and keeping it as dead simple as possible out of the box. That was our 1.0 focus. We've achieved a good portion of that. We're always looking to make it more simple for developers. We're building an add-on into VS Code so that developers can literally just spit out Envoy proxy configurations without really doing too much. But for us, the next stage is all the stuff we talk about with the analytics, the zero trust factor, the explicit security. Surfacing now that it's all in those data planes, going back to something we were talking about earlier with the proxies and the Nginx configs and the firewall rules, we actually could use the data plane to detect when somebody changes an explicit zero trust security rule. So we'd be able to surface that right away to a NOC or SOC, saying, hey, this proxy that is running on your mesh was allowed to speak to these five things, and somebody just changed it so it now can speak to everything. And that's not an easy thing to do today. When somebody goes into their enterprise and makes an Nginx configuration change, and that Nginx config change goes from this is allowed to receive and give traffic to and from the following nodes, a developer can just go change that. DevOps guy puts that out on your system. Next thing you know, it's deployed. Next thing you know, you're dealing with data leaks, and then everybody's going to be scratching their head saying, "What just happened? How did we have all these monitoring capabilities in place? What just happened?" But those monitoring capabilities are not paying attention to that kind of thing. They're paying attention to traffic. They're paying attention to where the traffic is coming from, whether it's where's all my ingress and egress coming from and going is what they're paying attention to. They're paying attention to are there, anomalies where the packets may look, a little bit out of band. And if they are, let's deal with it. They're looking for all that stuff. They're not actually working on the business itself. They're not actually saying this resource is running away and it's costing you X number of dollars. This resource was allowed to talk to these five things and now it's allowed to talk to everything. This resource was handing out this kind of data. your business told us that that kind of data can't go to that location or be shared with that service. Those things are all within our realm of possibility. And that's what we're focused on with Grey Matter.
So is there a, this might be a horrible analogy, but in some ways, you know, if I'm a developer working in an AWS only environment, you know, sort of native, all cloud, in a very small contained area, it sounds like Grey Matter can provide that same kind of ease of use and conformity across multi-cloud, including on-prem, and make it seem as easy as just working in one single, you know, public cloud ecosystem, a well-developed and mature one.
I wouldn't say all of the above, but yes, yeah. That is the goal. The goal is to take some things like, you know, CloudWatch and their audit capability and make that available to anything that you're running on your network, regardless of where it's hosted, where it's running. We've got a lot of customers who have, they've got assets in a Google Cloud, an Amazon Cloud, and an Azure Cloud, and you know, they all do a really nice job of what's going on in their cloud environments. It gets a little bit squirrely when you get down to the application level because you know, there's chargebacks and it's a little fuzzy on how deep you want to build into their particular SDK. But they all do a really nice job on their own stacks of all their monitoring. And I call it, I like to call it actionized monitoring, because it's not just monitoring. It's taking action based on that monitoring, which is really what matters. And we actually can normalize that entire thing across all three of those clouds and your on-prem cloud. So you get all of that without having to wire yourself to a particular cloud vendor. The other thing I will say is within a stack, we actually love Amazon. We love Amazon's managed services. We use Amazon managed services for many, many things. But we have, and I can't imagine we're different. We've got assets running on EC2s. We've got assets running on EKS. And we've got some assets that are playing in ECS, their container service. Because Amazon it's a full up cloud platform. It's got a lot of choice. And developers like to experiment all the
That's
time.
That's an understatement.
And the enterprise doesn't either understand that experimentation or doesn't understand the return on investment of that experimentation, because ECS may actually be cheaper than running EKS or whatever. And they usually don't find out that it was even happening until something bad happens, which is unfortunate. And you can actually put a Grey Matter mesh in place in an all Amazon environment, and you can actually surface a lot of those insights. So the developers and really the IT department doesn't need to hide anymore. The IT department can say, look, here were your requirements, line manager. We tried to use this capability because this capability, you know, when we sat down and did our analysis, this set of databases, this container management system, it met our needs faster in the time to market, and we thought it was going to scale better. Here's the actual reports. Either that's true or that's not true. So there's a lot of value by just bridging those things together from one VPC to another VPC to another VPC. We have customers doing that today as well. So it's not just multi-cloud or hybrid. It's even inside single clouds.
Chris, as a technologist, when you think about sort of the type of specialist that might want to learn more about this, you know, that might want to go to your website and watch your videos and kind of deep dive on this, are the people you worked with day to day, you know, hands on the keyboard type people, are these DevOps people? Are they security specialists, network engineers? Like, where do you kind of see those specialty areas?
All of the above. We've been at this point, and that's a two-pronged question for me anyway, because, you know, we've been running in production at this point for 2 years in some of the largest enterprises. And that 2 years has granted us lots of different use cases that have come through the pipe. from the can we deploy a portion of the mesh on a 1U server or a laptop and connect it to the broader mesh so that, you know, we can do all the command and control stuff in a decentralized, you know, environment. And I don't mean decentralized from a we've got a lot of data planes running. I mean from a people process. You know, people deploy, they want to be able to talk through potentially satcoms or some hardwire, and they've got to be able to communicate, and all that has to happen. So all the way to, you know, we run in data centers and we talk to the security people. You know, this is where the value add comes in. Now the security people, it's less about the explicit shared rules because it's easier. It's more about the data that they can get from that. And they have the same business missions that everybody else has. You know, their job in an enterprise is, I don't want to end up on the news because of a leak. So yeah, they have to run data science activities to find out what content's going where. Are they allowed to see it? I didn't even know these people were able to access that database. And those are the kinds of rules or data that we can give to them. We talk to the DevOps engineers and the developers. Honestly, we focused less on the developers and DevOps when we first came out of the funnel. And that, you know, everybody around us, all the open source projects are all focused on the DevOps guys and the developers. And that's fair. We as a company decided that our mission was business enterprise, and the value that we can bring to all of the business enterprise. We focused on the security people. We focused on the line managers. We focused on the architects and the managers and what they would need out of something like this. Now that we've reached that level of maturity with Gray Matter, we are going back and saying, okay, so we've been running for 2+ years in prod. People are very happy. How can we make this even easier for developers and DevOps engineers? Because if you're looking at the spectrum of things, especially when you're trying to sell software from a small startup, you really do have to focus on who your end users are. And you know, we chose to focus on the folks that tend to make decisions and spend the money. The developers and the DevOps engineers are super high influencers, but they can also sustain the most pain because it's their job to understand how to use a wrench or how to use a hammer or how to use a saw. And now we're going to go back and say, hey, thanks for sticking with us. We're going to make your lives a hell of a lot easier. We're going to give you template engines. We're going to give you one button deployment. We've spent a lot of time and effort on tooling this year. One button Terraform, rip it down, put it back up. If you're deploying into Kubernetes, you know, here's our Helm installs. We're looking at raw CRDs in the future. But Gray Matter and the service mesh space itself, and this is one of the differences that we took. We did not tie ourselves to Kubernetes. I think that came out loud and clear earlier. It is an environment. It is not the environment. And this mesh network layer, it is something that should be available to multiple deployment environments, not just if you have a container that you're deploying into a Kubernetes environment.
No, that seems to defeat the whole spirit of what you're trying to do. You know, it's interesting because I've spoken to more and more companies lately that have begun to question the long-term business sense of heavy public cloud investments. And so I'm beginning to see more and more companies hybridize their own deployments, not just in terms of using multiple public cloud providers, but they're starting to ask themselves, for long-term storage, would I be better off to do that locally versus S3?
Yep.
Right. And one of the complexities of those decisions is that, you know, if you don't have some sort of a high-end service mesh before you start, then it makes it really limits your opportunities and the way that you can think about it. And so what I'm kind of hoping happens is that, you know, your product and technology and everyone else in the space, that this space matures to a point that organizations can really start to make hybrid compute and storage environments in a way that hasn't been done before.
Yeah.
Where you might abstract components. You might decide for specific microservices whether to run those on your own infrastructure and owned hardware versus something in a public cloud. And with the right service mesh, you can make that seamless. It can all be secure. You can move it around. And I think that more than pays for what they're going to invest to get the service mesh done. So now you're saving money, you're saving time, you're more secure, you have the analytics. It becomes the kind of thing that, yes, there's a little bit of a startup time to get it up and running, but once you've done it, the freedom that it provides to you is really unmatched out there. And I think that's the thing people need to understand, is that this is not the type of technology that constrains your choices. It's the type of technology that opens up your choices.
Yes.
And really gives you, you know, the flexibility and the optionality to say, okay, well, we're going to be more creative. You know, we're going to choose the best, most secure, most cost-effective solutions without respect to where it comes from.
Yeah.
And it'll allow things to move that way. And that's something I don't think as it has happened yet. I think this is an evolution in cloud computing that, you know, is quite probably being accelerated because of coronavirus and we're all remote. And, you know, just suddenly all of our networks grew exponentially in terms of number of nodes and sites by the number of employees you had and how many places they worked from. And so in a way, I think that maybe what we're seeing is this rapid acceleration of not just what the product can do, but new and innovative ways to take advantage of it.
Yes.
And that's something I'm very excited about seeing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree 100%. I don't have a tremendous amount to add. I mean, done right. It's funny, a couple weeks ago in one of our production environments, somebody said, well, you know, I don't really understand this data plane thing that you're talking about. I'm not using it. And I stopped that person and said, actually, you are. And let me show you what's happening under the covers. And when I showed that person the reports that were being generated and the fact that he didn't have to deal with rotational certificates on the network because it was automatically dealing with those cert rotations and he was never going to get stuck in developer hell for, oh my God, my cert just expired, or the reverse, which we see a lot in enterprises. Certs hang around for 3+ years because they don't want to deal with them. You know, all those things add up. And the developer looked at me and he goes, oh my God, I didn't realize this. And in this market, the best platforms are going to be the ones that sort of do fall into that category of they don't even know it's there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, seriously, I have my Wi-Fi router, and if I had to deal with my Wi-Fi router every hour because of a problem, I'm going to throw my Wi-Fi router out the window and go buy another one where I can just put it under my shelf, and all I pay attention to it if the light turns a different color.
Yeah,
I mean that's this technology.
No, it's fascinating. I think that the largest impediment to growth that you guys have seen is just that. It's a complicated story when you try to explain what it does and how it works, but it's elegant in its simplicity in terms of the way it works and how seamless and completely invisible it is to most of the people that are benefiting from it.
Yes.
And so it's, you know, this is, I think, one of the challenges that happens when you're out ahead of the market, you know, when you're in a space very early and you're waiting on the space to mature and you don't have any help in the marketplace to help educate and bring up your potential consumers to a standard level of knowledge so that you can start, you know, in a 5-part discussion, you can start at step 3
right,
in a sales call, right? And the problem right now is that in every conversation, you have to start at step 1. we're at the end of our time today, and we've just now, I think, really gotten to the point that unless you're a network engineer or DevOps person or security person, you probably have started to understand what we're talking about. It's a complex problem with a very elegant and easy to implement solution. And so I just love the product, Chris. I've been a fan for a long time, and it's been fun as an investor or potential investor, you know, to sort of watch you guys grow and also to watch the problems in the space and listen to enterprises combat these issues and then start to see the light bulbs come on. I hope to see this market mature in such a way that the best products and the best solutions, you know, rise to the top. All too often what we find is that a good solution with great marketing rises to the top. And so we'll have to see.
Yes.
No offense to all my marketing friends out there. It's it's something we all love to work on. But I think that this is really, we're at sort of a turning point in the industry. And, you know, I do believe we're seeing an acceleration in terms of how this works. I want to ask one more question. We're way over on time, but
fire.
Help me understand the bridge or the relationship between service mesh and network automation platforms. Do they integrate or are they separate? How does that work?
So, you know, I think I used to say early on when we first started Decipher, we actually had a customer meeting in London, and we talked a lot about NFV, Network Functional Virtualization, and SDN, the software-defined networking, and then just general intent-based networking, network automation. And the service mesh really is the pointy tip of the spear. You have to have something like it in place on all of your environments if you're really going to see value out of network intent-based automation. Otherwise, you're going to have a really nice, layer two, layer one management system where you're probably going to have a little bit less rule-based routing. And then you're also going to have a separate and distinct, really cool cyber AI operation that is looking at anomaly detections and making sure that your packets are good packets and not bad packets. Again, looking at different layers on the OSI stack. The service mesh can bridge all of those investments together. It becomes a feeder of data to those things. It also becomes a way to actionize your application stacks, your microservices that you're building, your cross-cloud and on-prem stacks all together. It really is sort of that glue in the middle of all those kinds of things.
Awesome. Well, Chris, as I said, we're out of time.
Yep.
We'll have you back on the show soon. That was fantastic. I'd love to check back in a few months and see how things are going.
And sure.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah. Thanks, Josh. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Bye-bye. That's it, everyone. And thank you for joining Capital Geek. Subscribe via Apple, Stitcher, or any platform where you usually find fantastic podcasts. Tune in again soon for another great episode of Capital Geek.